Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge introduces incredible stories shared by women across the globe who have experienced the great heights of success and, at times, the agony of defeat. With a vision to impart wisdom and advice on how to tackle barriers and soar to new heights, the show uncovers different perspectives to help you find your inner strength and to power up your own voice so you can excel in life.
Welcome to Women Worldwide. I'm your host, Deirdre Breckenridge, bringing you more stories about incredible women who share their knowledge and let you in on their amazing experiences, all to help you learn and grow along the way. My special guest today is Farah Bostic. Farah is the founder and head of strategy for The Difference Engine, an insight-driven product strategy company. They help businesses to test assumptions in a continually changing world about who your customers are, what they want, and why they want it, and build a repository of customer intimacy into a tangible business asset. Farah's expertise in digital strategy and design, technology, web and mobile trends, and product and service design ensures her clients' brands deliver a seamless experience online and offline. She's honed her experience as an advisor to the world's most respected brands, including Apple, Microsoft, Disney, Samsung, and UPS. Quite an impressive list. Earlier in her career, Farah was a digital creative director, group planning director, brand strategist, and innovation lead, working with some of the most creative and strategic agencies and consultancies in the world, including Wieden & Kennedy, Digitas, Hall & Partners, and OTX. So, without any further delay, Farah, it is such a pleasure to have you on my show. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's really nice to join you.
Oh, well, thank you. And let's just pick it right up. I remember you saying you called yourself a refugee from the advertising world. Tell us a little bit about why you started your own company, The Difference Engine.
Well, I suppose, you know, I like to joke that I just make a terrible employee, but actually I think in many respects it had to do with starting my career in my early 20s working in advertising agencies. And at a certain point, I remember calling my dad and saying, I really don't know how these companies make money. And, you know, fast forward about 15 years later, where I'm a group planning director at a large agency, looking at budgets and burn reports and going, I see how we don't really make much money. the expenses are high, the margins are low, and that's just sort of the nature of that business. And I think the reason I was set up to think that way was that in the late 90s, building digital products really from scratch, you suddenly encountered realities about your creative ideas. So we want to build an online store for the Fred Siegel store on Melrose. But in order to do that, we've got to digitize the inventory system. So suddenly you go from thinking about building a beautiful website to thinking about the business realities and logistics of a retail business. So I think in many respects, I was just sort of, after that, a bad fit for such a small part of the brand's life cycle. Which is advertising, an important part, but a small part. And really the reason I wanted to start my own business was I wanted to get closer to products, but still stay on that kind of consultancy edge. And that's what The Difference Engine is really all about.
That's really great. And you had mentioned, in the research, and the research is so important, that people lie when it comes to their research responses. So as a researcher, what is the best way to prevent this from happening?
So I think actually my reaction to that is often one of, we lean into the lies. Instead of expecting people to be accurate reporters of their own past behavior, which they're just not. I mean, just sort of cognitively and evolutionarily, we're not set up to be great recorders and reporters of what we did yesterday or even what we did an hour ago. And I think the unfortunate thing is that we do tend to cast it as people are lying, as opposed to people are doing their best to answer a question that is impossible for them to answer accurately and faithfully. And so instead, what I like to do is, get away from those types of questions where it's, you know, self-report, tell me about how you prepare to go to the grocery store, tell me about what you buy when you go there. They'll get it 60%+ right, depending on the person. But instead, ask them to do a variety of exercises around that. So some of it is observational, some of it is self-reported, some of it is telling me stories about how they approach grocery shopping, for instance. And these things help me start to get a sense of both behaviorally what they do, as well as what they think they do, and then how they have constructed their kind of values and beliefs around what they do. And all of those things should allow me to triangulate towards a truth about how people engage in a particular category or behavior. And so in general, I think it's don't get too exercised about the fact that people aren't perfectly accurate reporters, and instead embrace those fuzzy stories and those kinds of values-based recitations of what they think they did, and as part of the total kind of the total piece of the pie. I often think about it as when we're designing products, we really do need to know what people do, and we need to see them do it and observe them using that product. On the other hand, when we're talking about marketing, it's okay to talk about those lies. It's okay to understand what those feelings are. In fact, it's important that we do that because often it's the emotional connection and the wish fulfillment that marketing is there to fulfill or to connect with. So I sort of embrace the lies, I suppose.
It sounds like you attack from a lot of different angles to truly be able to design products the right way and to, I guess, for people, you know, like you said, if there are certain questions, they're set up to lie. So if you look at different ways to observe their behavior, you must get a better picture of what they like and what they would use and how they would feel.
Yeah, I mean, I frequently say that, you know, in order to do great design research, we have to have great research design. And so a lot of what I think traditional research kind of does is sets everybody who's participating up to fail. It sets the research participants up to fail. We're asking them questions they can't easily answer or can't answer accurately. We're asking, you know, the researchers to, you know, pretend they don't need to know that much about what people really do in order to have a meaningful conversation with them in a fake, you know, situation like a focus group facility. We're asking the clients who are sitting behind mirrors with their laptops in front of them and their cell phones buzzing to pay attention to and empathize with those customers who are sitting in the observation box. A lot of it is really set up for everybody to fail. And I think just like good products, we shouldn't design products so that the people who are going to use them feel like they're failing at simple actions. We shouldn't design research so that everybody's failing at the research either. So yes, we like to take multiple ways into understanding behavior and understanding emotional responses and understanding the stories people tell about what they do and the products they do it with. And we find that tends to be the most fulfilling approach to research. And actually, in a kind of counterintuitive way, it winds up being a much lighter weight, much more agile way of doing the research because you can be more adaptive and you can do things in situ. You don't have to spend the money on all the trappings of traditional science-y research by being, you know, actually with people where they do what they do.
So is that what you mean when you say research isn't design?
Well, when I talk about that, I think one of the things that I think is, you know, a misuse of research, and I tend to boil it down to my least favorite sentence in business, which is, we're going to go off and do some research, which pretty much says that we're going to, you know, call time on the play. Half the players are going to leave the field, and they're going to go do something for about 6 weeks that no one else gets to see and no one else gets to participate in, and then they're going to come back, and now we're going to have a new plan. And everybody who's sort of left standing around scratching their heads wondering what's going on are just supposed to get on board with that new plan. And I think that that's where, in my mind, we have sacrificed research's actual place within the design process by making it its own thing. And so I sometimes think that, you know, when I have people who quote at me that, you know, Steve Jobs didn't believe in doing research, the first thing I usually say to them is, really, that's interesting, because when I worked on his account, we did research, and I have lots of friends who have done research for Apple since then. So I think the difference is they do the right kind of research at the right point in time. But if you actually look at his kind of the oft-used quote from Steve Jobs about focus groups, he basically says, you know, focus groups, It's really hard to design new products using focus groups. A lot of times people need to see something before they can imagine it, right? And and I think that's actually a really smart description of how to do research well. Focus groups aren't always the right tool. In fact, often for innovation, they're the wrong tool. And then I think the other side of it is you've got to show people prototypes. You've got to do scenario planning. You've got to create design fiction for people to react to future states and potential worlds that they might inhabit. If you just ask them about, you know, what do you think about a new X, they do tend to default to, could it be faster or cheaper or easier than the thing I do now, which is usually incremental change, not true innovation change. And so I think when I talk about research is not design, it is not the part that's going to arrive at the answer. It's the part that's going to inspire the answer. And so we do a lot of co-creative work with designers and developers and product teams and with consumers to try to kind of inspire the design process as opposed to trying to supplant it.
Oh, that's really interesting. What about gender and research? Are companies gathering the right research and using it properly to target men and women? Do you find in general?
It depends on the brand. Certainly, I mean, I've definitely been the recipient of briefs from clients where they have done some quantitative surveying and some segmentation, perhaps. And in a segmentation study, they discover that a particular target that they would like to reach skews male. And then when you actually dig into the data, the skew is within the margin of error. And, you know, it's 54% male and 46% female with a margin of error of 5 points. And so, you go, well, even if it weren't a margin of error of 5 points, you're still talking about half the audience that you are now basically saying we're going to ignore because we like the story better about men. And I think sometimes those decisions about how to profile a target actually wind up being about pre-existing beliefs and biases more than they are about the actual data. And so, you know, the one example I'm thinking of, this was a segment that was called Tech Enthusiasts. So even though it was 46, 48% female, in people's minds, when they imagine a tech enthusiast, they imagine a 30-something educated, affluent white man, which has very little to do with the reality of who buys smartphones and who uses the internet and who is on, you know, who's playing mobile games and console games and who's, you know, serving up their own Unix and Linux servers. Like, it's got nothing to do with that. There's lots of people of lots of stripes doing that kind of behavior. And the their own segmentation bore that out, but it was easier to believe the kind of pre-existing case, which we think of, and that's, you know, white guys in their 30s, you know, 20s and 30s. So I think there's still a fair amount of that. I think the other side of where research and gender gets tricky is that, you know, we're often dealing with, if you look at sort of advertising research, you're often in a situation where you're now after the fact. A campaign has already been developed, creative ideas have already been concepted, and now you're out testing those ideas. And so once again, you're testing it with some not necessarily well-proven suppositions about who the target audience is. And then you're also testing it with creative that might have been designed by people who are not the target audience. So the other thing that we'll frequently see is advertising or products aimed at women that were entirely designed for men. And, you know, it's not 100% of the time that that's a dud, but right. Frequently there's sort of something that could have been learned had some women been in the room at the outset. So we do sometimes see these kind of disconnects between the thing that has been developed and the people that it's intended for. And so a lot of times that is informed by gender. But I think the bigger issue that I see is companies thinking that they don't need to test those hypotheses. They don't think they are hypotheses. They think they're just true. And so they make assumptions about gender and the role that it plays in the types of products they're trying to sell. And you see this, for instance, in certain kinds of apparel and performance wear. So, you know, Lululemon makes lots of products that are intended, you know, with fabrics and construction details that are meant to be there for movement and women's bodies, but they don't sell that as a performance message because their audience is primarily women. Now, however, they've got an entirely male board, and they are starting to target men, and they're doing it by selling a technology story. We've got these performance fabrics and this construction thing, and that's a very gendered response to the market, which is kind of silly, especially if you look down the street at what Uniqlo is doing, and they're selling performance fabrics, but they haven't made a decision about, well, men care about performance and women don't. They basically said everybody who is going to buy heat tech, you know, apparel or our special down, you know, lightweight down, everybody who cares about that has a body that needs to be kept a particular kind of warm and cool. And guess what? That's just human. So they put men and women in their advertising and don't worry about it so much. I suspect Uniqlo will sort of do better at that than Lululemon will. But that's where the kinds of things around gender we see come up over and over again. It's just sort of inherent bias, unconscious bias, making suppositions about what women care about and what men care about in a very gendered way without actually going and finding out.
Well, it sounds like making these assumptions can certainly move you away from your target, and you have to be careful. I'm talking with my special guest, Farah Bostic, founder and head of strategy at The Difference Engine. In the next segment, Farah will share her thoughts on the biggest challenges as an entrepreneur and business owner.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Segment 2 is coming right up.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Pure Performance Communications works with businesses to move their audiences from interest to action, giving you a roadmap that fosters deeper engagement and forges stronger relationships along the way. Visit us at pureperformance.com. Thank you.
Now, back to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge.
I'm Deirdre Breckenridge, host of Women Worldwide. Welcome back to the show, where Farah Bostic and I were just chatting about the importance of research and proper targeting. So, Farah, when you were younger, and this is a more personal question, did you always love math and science, and did you think that you were going to do research as you got older? Where did this all come from?
Well, you know, I did love math and science. I think what's interesting is I primarily do qualitative research, so I'm keenly interested in the data, and we do a lot of work helping clients design for better analytics and metrics. I did love math and science. I had parents who loved math and science and were very encouraging of it. And I didn't always want to do research when I got older. Actually, what I wanted to do was be a writer, which is how I wound up working in advertising. And really that path is a funny one because I think, you know, the point in time that I decided and I think the way I expressed it was, you know, when I get to be 25 years old, I want to be a writer and have the pay stubs to prove it. I thought I was very sophisticated, but I was not going to be a starving artist. I was going to write.
Right. Who wants to be a starving artist?
Exactly. And so, you know, my parents gave me some good advice. We were looking at colleges, University of Oregon, which is where I wound up getting my undergraduate degree, had a journalism program with an advertising emphasis. And so that's where that education came from. But even the idea that there were such things as people who wrote the ads, I think hadn't occurred to me until my dad set up his own business after having been laid off in the high-tech hardware industry during one of its little recessions. And he started his own business, and he was setting up the local area network at Weidman City, and was spending all this time in a cool office with interesting people working on interesting stuff. And he was sort of bring home these little artifacts from Weidman Kennedy's offices and told me that I should really think about working in advertising, which I think was the first time I realized there was such a thing as a job in advertising. I think in many respects, this is one of the things that I'm actually really passionate about now, is the idea of connecting the dots for kids about their passions to potential jobs. Because I actually think if we went back to when I was about 12 and what I wanted to be then, if I'd known there was a job doing it, I would have gone into special effects and video game design and things like that, because I was really into computers and really into computer graphics. But I think all of those things kind of come together. I love technology, I love products, I love design, I love people. I'm sort of intellectually curious, and I'm also just curious about people. I think that compassion and empathy are things that make the world a better place, and that this is a way for me to kind of express that in the world of business. And so in a way, through all paths, and it's been a circuitous one, and a set of paths have led me to this place where I get to influence product design and work with data and people in order to sort of add value into the marketplace.
It's so great the way everything came together. And it's also wonderful that you're helping to connect dots for kids, because, you know, it's so important that when we grow up, sometimes there are things that we would love to do, but if we don't know that they're out there and if nobody helps us, you certainly can't cultivate at a young age. I'm amazed that you love math and science. Not many younger women say that. So that's good. We need more math and science lovers too. Speaking of love and hate, so what do you love and hate about being an entrepreneur? How has it changed your life?
Oh, it's completely changed my life. So
I know, right?
Exactly. There is a lot to love about it. I mean, it's certainly quite freeing. I have managed now over the last 4 years to actually be in a place where there are really no projects I work on that are truly a bad fit. You know, I think this year I worked on a couple of projects that were more about designing content for events, which is a little off, you know, from center of what it is that we do. It was a great learning experience and certainly taught us that we probably won't do that again.
but you live and learn.
It is a type of, yeah, exactly. But it is a type of a type of product. And I think, you know, on the one hand, it's great that I now am in this sort of sweet spot where, unlike an agency life or in the research companies I've worked in, where you might work on something that you think is trivial or too late or badly designed or, you know, that you just don't care about. I think just about everything I've worked on over the last 2.5 years is now exactly the type of thing that I'm interested in, exactly the type of challenge that I like to address. And so that's great. And I also now have a kind of network of consultants and freelancers that I'm able to bring in for projects where their skills are just really going to shine and come to life. And I love that kind of collaborative process. The flip side of it, of course, is you are now responsible for everything.
So, yes, you are.
You know, you've got to chase the invoices, and you've got to stay up to date on those, and you've got to answer your bookkeeper's questions, and you've got to file your taxes on time, and you've got to manage your cash flow, and you know, all of those things. And it is pretty scary. And you know, I have a law degree, and the number of things that I'm not sure I'm doing correctly according to, you know, regulations is just staggering. And so those things are very stressful. I think the other thing that can be tricky about being an entrepreneur as opposed to having a company behind you is developing the nerve to say to clients, this is what it costs. You know,
yeah.
This is how long it takes. This is the way we do it. And not having to feel like you're sort of obliged to bend and flex to everything.
Right. So yeah, sticking to your price is so important because you know what it takes to get the outcome that they're looking for.
Absolutely. And that I think is probably the hardest part. I don't know if it's harder for women or men. I know a lot of women who complain about, you know, trying to figure out the same thing and being, you know, really stressed out about asking for money. But then again, my friend Cindy Gallup's advice is to ask for the biggest number you can say out loud without laughing. which is terrific.
Great advice.
Yes. But I think really it is about learning as you go. What does it really take to complete a project of this size and shape? And then, you know, are you being, you know, paid in a way that's commensurate with that kind of work and that kind of value that you're bringing? And then being willing to stand there and say that this is how we do it as a business, and this is what it costs, and this is how long it takes, and sticking your guns on that. I think that's been a huge challenge. But then again, there are all of these other trade-offs, which is, you know, I have a relative amount of freedom. I work from home and all over the world. I get to travel when I want to, and also travel for my clients. So there's a lot of flexibility that comes with all of the responsibility, which is great.
Yeah, on the one side, it almost is the dream job as an entrepreneur because of the flexibility, and, you know, you said no projects that are a bad fit, but there are so many challenges, you know, earlier on in the business. Were there any other challenges that you faced before you had to get to the next level? Or do you ever feel like even delegating is a challenge as an entrepreneur? Anything like that?
Delegating is a huge challenge. And I think there were kind of two things. One is getting to a place where I had a clear articulation of what it was I wanted my business to be, that I could get that out in, you know, two sentences. and that took a long time. And a lot of it was trying to get used to the idea that I wanted to say things in plain, clear English. And so I experimented with all kinds of ways of trying to explain what I do in plain, clear English. And all I really did was confound the matter even more. So I discovered that, strategic use of jargon is actually better for communication than not. and so that took some time. Delegation has been a huge challenge. Early last year, I had attempted to, or started to kind of experiment with bringing someone on board who would be a partner in the business. Who had skills that I thought were my weak point. And we tried that for a few months and basically discovered, A, that wasn't enough of a weak point. It actually wasn't that painful of a problem for me. And it was project management skills, really. And B, it didn't solve a bigger problem, which is that when you bring a partner into the business, that partner should either kind of double your capacity to execute work,
right,
or they should double the deal flow. And, you know, even if they don't double it, you know, ideally they can, you know, significantly increase both simultaneously.
They have to come with their own channel, their own
exactly.
book of business almost.
Right. And that was something that this particular person didn't have. And so we parted ways, and that was, you know, an expensive lesson for me and I think an important lesson for her as well about what type of business she wanted to be in and who she wanted to partner with and how she wanted to work and be paid. So those things were quite challenging. The next phase of that was I did a full-time hire of a more junior person who had worked for me before, had great skills, was a wonderful person to work with. But this was also at a point in time where there was a particular kind of work that I knew I could 100% delegate to her and she could just run with that. And then that cycle kind of petered out and there wasn't enough of that work to keep her busy, you know, all year long. And because of that, it was sort of, you know, she was nervous all the time. Even if I could afford to keep her, which I could have, you know, she just found it very stressful to be sort of sitting around going, I have nothing I can help you with and nothing really to do. So I think there are also some things about knowing when to bring people on and who, you know, to whom you are going to delegate what. And so now, you know, I do have, I have a tax accountant and then a lawyer and they're great. And I don't need to talk to them very often, which is great. I have
even better.
Yeah.
Well,
now I have other people to handle some of those things.
Well, it sounds like you've learned some really valuable lessons. I'm a firm believer that you have to mess up in order to move forward to be better. You know, otherwise, we wouldn't be learning constantly. So I think it's good that you know, whether it's the partner or the new hire, these are the things that we have to find out. And I'm really glad that you have the lawyer and the accountant, because I always say that for every entrepreneur, make sure you have those two people, really good lawyer and a really good accountant. It's so important.
Exactly.
So you are super busy. There's no doubt about it. And I know the entrepreneurial lifestyle. What do you do to relax? Or do you get to relax? Maybe I should ask that question.
So up until about the end of October, middle end of October, relaxing was not a thing I had done this year. This includes the, you know, working while technically on vacation kind of thing, which I did twice this year. But it was also a big year. There was a large project that ran for about 9 months. There were, you know, 4, 5, 6 clients simultaneously throughout the summer. And then I also, you know, went and got married. So,
congratulations.
Thank you. All of those things kind of came together to being, there was no free time for anything. But when I do get to relax, there are a few things I like to do. One is, I like to actually read paper books. It's shocking, I know.
No, I love that too.
Super digital, but yeah,
I
mean, especially as a bedtime ritual, someone gave me this advice of basically having no electronics in the bedroom. And if you're going to reading a proper book on, it's just something about screens and the stimulus.
It wakes
your brain
up, the screen. Yeah, exactly. And it's so nice to hold a book in your hand. Sometimes I feel like when I hold a book in my hand, and I always read every night before I go to bed, nothing business, it's like being on vacation. It just takes me back to a nice time and away from digital.
Exactly.
Well, that's really good.
And that's one thing. And then on the flip side of it, I like to play video games. We have a PlayStation, and I'm currently working on the new Batman game. It's pretty great, actually.
Oh, that's so cool. Awesome. So you sound like you get to, I'm glad you're relaxing now. What advice would you give to other professionals about, you know, being an entrepreneur, tough obstacles in business? What would you tell them?
I think the most important thing, the thing that has really made a difference for me in managing these obstacles has been, or just these challenges along the way, has really been not going it alone. And that comes for a few things. One is, you know, maintaining relationships with colleagues you trust, and even though they're no longer your work colleagues, they're still your professional colleagues. And so, you know, you've got a sounding board, and they understand because they do similar work, or they work with similar clients, or just they've worked with you. And so they understand why you're having the reaction that you're having. I think the other thing that's been an enormous boon for me has been membership in a professional organization here in New York, known as The List, which is, you know, 300 some women in technology and business and in media. Also, you know, some people from nonprofits and other kinds of fields. And we're able to kind of tap each other through what's effectively a Google group for advice on all kinds of things. And those things are, you know, finding a great accountant, also, you know, finding a great gynecologist, or getting advice on where to get a suit or a dress for an event that you need, or just being able to say, I'm having a bad day, I'm not feeling motivated, I'm having trouble with a client, I'm not sure how to handle this situation, and having, you know, having some peers, some you've met in person, some you haven't, who are able to offer advice or at least consolation as you're going through that. I think the main thing really is creating a network around yourself, whether you have a trade organization or not, of people that you trust. Be a good sounding board, be just good listeners sometimes, and then also give great advice.
Excellent. All really, really good advice. The relationships are so important. So last question, Farah, where can my listeners find out more about you and the Difference Engine?
So probably the easiest place is on our website, which is thedifferenceengine.co. We're actually going to be resurrecting our tiny letter newsletter the first week of December, which is called Stoked. And so we'll be, you know, tweeting about that and sharing that with our current list. But I'm going to that website, and then you can follow me on Twitter, and it's just at Farah Bostic. So that's another good place to get in touch.
Terrific. Farah, thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your work at the Difference Engine and all of your strategic insight on research.
Wonderful. Thank you, Georgia.
My pleasure. And I'd also like to thank everyone for tuning into Women Worldwide. I'm your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. And until we meet again for our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge, brought to you by Pure Performance Communications on the socialnetworkstation.com. You can reach Pure Performance at www.pureperformancecom.com. Women Worldwide is produced by SNI, and the opinions of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect those of Social Network Intermedia, LLC, or the Social Network Station.